in the rehab unit. That Jim had lost his powers of speech and now impotently strained his jaw and lips to form words, that he'd become, according to reports from colleagues who'd visited him, an angry man, made Chip all the more reluctant to visit. He was in the mode now of avoiding anything that might make him experience an emotion. He beat on the steering wheel until his fingers were stiff and burning, and Melissa came out of the ecology house. She brought into the car a smell of wood smoke and frozen flower beds, the smell of an affair in late autumn. She put into Chip's palm a golden caplet marked with what appeared to be the old Midland Pacific Railroad logo, Midland Pacific Lines, without the text.
"Take this," she told him, closing the door.
"This is some kind of ecstasy?"
"No, Mexican A."
Chip felt culturally anxious. Not long ago there had been no drugs he hadn't heard of. "What does it do?"
"Nothing and everything," she said, swallowing one herself. "You'll see."
"How much do I owe you for this?"
"Never mind that."
For a while the drug did seem, as promised, to do nothing, but on the industrial outskirts of Norwich, still 2 or 3 hours from the Cape, he turned down the trip-hop that Melissa was playing on his stereo and said, "We have to stop immediately and fuck." She laughed.
"I guess so."
"Why don't I pull over?" he said. She laughed again.
"No, let's find a room."
They stopped at a Comfort Inn that had lost its franchise and now called itself the Comfort Valley Lodge. The night clerk was obese and her computer was down. She manually registered Chip with the labored breathing of someone lately stranded by a system's malfunction. Chip put his hand on Melissa's belly and was about to reach into her pants when it occurred to him that fingering a woman in public was inappropriate and might cause trouble. For similar, purely rational reasons, he suppressed the impulse to pull his dick out of his pants and show it to the wheezing, perspiring clerk. But he did think the clerk would be interested in seeing it. He took Melissa down on the cigarette-divoted carpeting of room 23 without even shutting the door.
"It's so much better like this," Melissa said, kicking the door shut. She yanked her pants down and practically wailed with delight. "This is so much better."
He didn't dress all weekend. The towel he was wearing when he took delivery of a pizza fell open before the delivery man could turn away.
"Hey, love, it's me,"
Melissa said into her cell phone while Chip lay down behind her and went at her. She kept her phone arm free and made supportive, filial noises.
"Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Sure. Sure. No, that's hard, Mom. No, you're right, that is hard. Sure. Sure. Uh-huh. Sure. That's really, really hard," she said, with a twinkle in her voice as Chip sought leverage for an extra sweet half-inch of penetration while he shot.
On Monday and Tuesday, he dictated large chunks of a term paper on Carol Gilligan, which Melissa was too annoyed with Vendla O'Fallon to write by herself. His near-photographic recall of Gilligan's arguments, his total mastery of theory, got him so excited that he began to tease Melissa's hair with his erection. He ran the head of it up and down the keyboard of her computer and applied a gleaming smudge to the liquid crystal screen.
"Darling," she said, "don't come on my computer."
He nudged her cheeks and ears and tickled her armpits and finally backed her up against the bathroom door while she bathed him in her cherry red smile. Each night around dinner time, for 4 nights running, she went to her luggage and got 2 more golden caplets. Then on Wednesday, Chip took her to a Cineplex, and they sneaked into an extra movie and a half for the price of the original matinee bargain. Back at the Comfort Valley Lodge, after a late pancake dinner, Melissa called her mother and spoke at such length that Chip fell asleep without swallowing a caplet. He awoke on Thanksgiving in the gray light of his undrugged self. For a while, as he lay listening to the sparse holiday traffic on Route 2, he couldn't place what was different. Something about the body beside him was making him uneasy. He considered turning and burying his face in Melissa's back, but it seemed to him she must be sick of him. He could hardly believe she hadn't minded his attacks on her, all his pushing and pawing and poking, that she didn't feel like a piece of meat that he'd been using. In a matter of seconds, like a market inundated by a wave of panic selling, he was plunged into shame and self-consciousness. He couldn't bear to stay in bed a moment longer. He pulled on his shorts and snagged Melissa's toiletries kit and locked himself in the bathroom. His problem consisted of a burning wish not to have done the things he'd done. And his body, its chemistry, had a clear instinctive understanding of what he had to do to make this burning wish go away. He had to swallow another Mexican A. He searched the toiletries kit exhaustively. He wouldn't have thought it possible to feel dependent on a drug with no hedonic kick, a drug that on the evening of his fifth and final dose he hadn't even craved. He uncapped Melissa's lipsticks and removed twin tampons from their pink plastic holder and probed with a bobby pin down through her jar of skin cleanser. Nothing. He took the kit back out to the main room, which was fully light now, and whispered Melissa's name. Receiving no answer, he dropped to his knees and rifled her canvas travel bag, paddled his fingers in the empty cups of bras, squeezed her sock balls, touched the various private pouches and compartments of the bag. This new and different violation of Melissa was sensationally painful to him. In the orange light of his shame, he felt as if he were abusing her internal organs. He felt like a surgeon atrociously fondling her youthful lungs, defiling her kidneys, sticking his finger in her perfect, tender pancreas. The sweetness of her little socks, and the thought of the even littler socks of her all-too-proximate girlhood, and the image of a hopeful, bright, romantic sophomore packing clothes for a trip with her esteemed professor, each sentimental association added fuel to his shame. Each image recalled him to the unfunny, raw comedy of what he'd done to her. The jismic, grunting butt-oink. The jiggling, frantic nut-swing. By now his shame was boiling so furiously, it felt liable to burst things in his brain. Nevertheless, while keeping a close eye on Melissa's sleeping form, he managed to paw her clothing a second time. Only after he'd re-squeezed and re-handled each piece of it did he conclude that the Mexican A was in the big, zippered outer pocket of her bag. This zipper he eased open tooth by tooth, clenching his own teeth to survive the noise of it. He'd worked the pocket open just far enough to push his hand through it, and the stress of this latest of his penetrations released fresh gusts of flammable memory. He felt mortified by each of the manual liberties he'd taken with Melissa here in room 23, by the insatiable, lewd avidity of his fingers. He wished he could have left her alone. When the cell phone on the nightstand tinkled, and with a groan she came awake. He snatched his hand from the forbidden place, ran to the bathroom, and took a long shower. By the time he came out, Melissa was dressed and had repacked her bag. She looked utterly uncarnal in the morning light. She was whistling a happy tune. "Darling, a change of plans," she said. "My father, who really is a lovely man, is coming out to Westport for the day. I want to go be with them." Chip wished he could fail to feel the shame that she was failing to feel. But to beg for another pill was acutely embarrassing. "What about our dinner?" he said. "I'm sorry. It's just really important that I be there." "So it's not enough to be on the phone with them for a couple of hours every day."
"Chip, I'm sorry, but we're talking about my best friends."
Chip had never liked the sound of Tom Paquette, a dilettante rocker and trust fund baby who ditched his family for a rollerblader. And in the last few days, Claire's boundless capacity to yak about herself while Melissa listened had turned Chip against her, too. "Great," he said. "I'll take you to Westport." Melissa flipped her hair so that it fanned across her back.
"Darling, don't be mad."
"If you don't want to go to the Cape, you don't want to go to the Cape. I'll take you to Westport."
"Good. Are you going to get dressed?"
"It's just that, Melissa, you know, there's something a little sick about being so close to your parents." She seemed not to have heard him. She went to the mirror and applied mascara. She put on lipstick. Chip stood in the middle of the room with a towel around his waist. He felt warty, and egregious. He felt that Melissa was right to be disgusted by him, and yet he wanted to be clear. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Darling. Chip, she pressed her painted lips together. Get dressed.
I'm saying, Melissa, that children are not supposed to get along with their parents. Your parents are not supposed to be your best friends. They're supposed to be some element of rebellion. That's how you define yourself as a person.
Maybe it's how you define yourself, she said. But then you're not exactly an advertisement for happy adulthood.
He grinned and bore this.
I like myself, she said. But you don't seem to like yourself so much.
Your parents seem very fond of themselves, too, he said. You seem very fond of yourselves as a family. He'd never seen Melissa really angry.
I love myself, she said. What's wrong with that?
He was unable to say what was wrong with it. He was unable to say what was wrong with anything about Melissa, her self-adoring parents, her theatricality and confidence, her infatuation with capitalism, her lack of good friends her own age. The feeling he'd had on the last day of consuming narratives, the feeling that he was mistaken about everything, that there was nothing wrong with the world and nothing wrong with being happy in it, that the problem was his and his alone, returned with such force that he had to sit down on the bed. What's our drug situation?
We're out, Melissa said.
Okay.
I got 6 of them, and you've had 5.
What?
And it was a big mistake, evidently, not to give you all 6.
What have you been taking?
Advil, darling.
Her tone, with this endearment, had moved beyond the arch to the outright ironic.
For saddle soreness?
I never asked you to get that drug, he said.
Not in so many words, she said.
What do you mean by that?
Well, a fat lot of fun we were going to have without it.
Chip didn't ask her to explain. He was afraid she meant he'd been a lousy, anxious lover until he took Mexican A. He had, of course, been a lousy, anxious lover, but he'd allowed himself to hope she hadn't noticed. Under the weight of this fresh shame, and with no drug left in the room to alleviate it, he bowed his head and pressed his hands into his face. Shame was pushing down, and rage was boiling up.
"Are you going to drive me to Westport?"
Melissa said. He nodded, but she must not have been looking at him because he heard her flipping through a phone book. He heard her tell a dispatcher she needed a ride to New London. He heard her say,
"The Comfort Valley Lodge, room 23."
"I'll drive you to Westport," he said.
She shut the phone. "No, this is fine."
"Melissa, cancel the cab. I'll drive you." She parted the room's rear curtains, exposing a vista of cyclone fencing, stick-straight maples, and the backside of a recycling plant. 8 or 10 snowflakes drifted dismally. In the eastern sky was a raw patch where the cloud cover was abraded, the white sun wearing through. Chip dressed quickly while Melissa's back was turned. If he hadn't been so strangely full of shame, he might have gone to the window and put his hands on her, and she might have turned and forgiven him. But his hands felt predatory. He imagined her recoiling, and he wasn't entirely convinced that some dark percentage of his being didn't really want to rape her, to make her pay for liking herself in a way he couldn't like himself. How he hated and how he loved the lilt in her voice, the bounce in her step, the serenity of her amour-propre. She got to be her, and he didn't. And he could see that he was ruined, that he didn't like her, but would miss her disastrously. She dialed another number.
"Hey, love,"
she said into her cell phone.
"I'm on my way to New London. I'll take the first train that comes." "No, I just want to be with you guys." "Totally. Yes, totally. Okay, kiss, kiss. I'll see you when I see you." "Yep."
A car honked outside the door.
"There's my cab," she told her mother. "Right. Okay. Kiss, kiss. Bye."
She shrugged into her jacket, lifted her bag, and waltzed across the room. At the door, she announced in a general way that she was leaving.
"I'll see you later," she said,
almost looking at Chip. He couldn't figure out if she was immensely well-adjusted or seriously messed up. He heard a cab door slam, an engine rumble. He went to the front window and got a glimpse of her cherry wood hair through the rear window of a red and white cab. He decided, after 5 years without, that the time had come to buy some cigarettes. He put on a jacket and crossed expanses of cold asphalt, indifferent to pedestrians. He pushed money through a slot in the bulletproof glass of a mini-mart. It was the morning of Thanksgiving. The flurries had stopped, and the sun was halfway out. A gull's wings rattled and clacked. The breeze had a ruffly quality. It didn't quite seem to touch the ground. Chip sat on a freezing guardrail and smoked, and took comfort in the sturdy mediocrity of American commerce, the unpretending metal and plastic roadside hardware. The thunk of a gas pump nozzle halting when a tank was filled, the humility and promptness of its service, and a 99-cent Big Gulp banner swelling with wind and sailing nowhere, its nylon ropes whipping and pinging on a galvanized standard, and the black sans-serif numerals of gasoline prices, the company of so many nines, and American sedans moving down the access road at nearly stationary speeds like 30, and orange and yellow plastic pennants shivering overhead on guys.
"Dad fell down the basement stairs again," Enid said while the rain came down in New York City. "He was carrying a big box of pecans to the basement, and he didn't hold the railing and he fell. Well, you can imagine how many pecans are in a 12-pound box. Those nuts rolled everywhere. Denise, I spent half a day on my hands and knees, and I'm still finding them. They're the same color as those crickets we can't get rid of. I reach down to pick up a pecan, and it jumps in my face."
Denise was trimming the stems of the sunflowers she'd brought.
"Why was Dad carrying 12 pounds of pecans down the basement stairs?" "He wanted a project he could work on in his chair. He was going to shell them." Enid hovered at Denise's shoulder. "Is there something I can do here?" "You can find me a vase."
The first cabinet that Enid opened contained a carton of wine bottle corks and nothing else.
"I don't understand why Chip invited us here if he wasn't even going to eat lunch with us." "Conceivably," Denise said, "he didn't plan on getting dumped this morning."
Denise's tone of voice was forever informing Enid that she was stupid. Denise was not, Enid felt, a very warm or giving person. However, Denise was a daughter, and a few weeks ago Enid had done a shameful thing that she was now in serious need of confessing to somebody, and she hoped Denise might be that person.
"Gary wants us to sell the house and move to Philadelphia," she said. "Gary thinks Philadelphia makes sense because he's there, and you're there, and Chip's in New York. I said to Gary, I love my children, but St. Jude is where I'm comfortable. Denise, I'm a Midwesterner. I'd be lost in Philadelphia. Gary wants us to sign up for assisted living. He doesn't understand that it's already too late. Those places won't let you in if you have a condition like Dad's."
"But if Dad keeps falling down the stairs..."
"Denise, he doesn't hold the railing. He refuses to accept that he shouldn't be carrying things on the stairs."
Underneath the sink, Enid found a vase behind a stack of framed photographs. 4 pictures of pinkish, furry things. Some sort of kooky art or medical photos. She tried to reach past them quietly, but she knocked over an asparagus steamer that she'd given Chip for Christmas once. As soon as Denise looked down, Enid could not pretend she hadn't seen the pictures.
"What on earth?" she said, scowling. "Denise, what are these?"
"What do you mean, what are these?"
"Some sort of kooky thing of Chip's, I guess."
Denise had an amused expression that drove Enid crazy.
"Obviously you know what they are, though."
"No, I don't."
"You don't know what they are?"
Enid took the vase out and closed the cabinet.
"I don't want to know," she said.
"Well, that's something else entirely."
In the living room, Alfred was summoning the courage to sit down on Chip's chaise longue. Not 10 minutes ago he'd sat down on it without incident, but now, instead of simply doing it again, he'd stopped to think. He'd realized only recently that at the center of the act of sitting down was a loss of control, a blind, backwards free-fall. His excellent blue chair in St. Jude was like a first baseman's glove that gently gathered in whatever body was flung its way, at whatever glancing angle, with whatever violence. It had big, helpful, ursine arms to support him while he performed the crucial blind pivot. But Chip's chaise was a low-riding, impractical antique. Alfred stood facing away from it and hesitated, his knees bent to the rather small degree that his neuropathic lower legs permitted, his hands scooping and groping in the air behind him. He was afraid to take the plunge. And yet there was something obscene about standing half-crouched and quaking, some association with the men's room, some essential vulnerability which felt to him at once so poignant and degraded that, simply to put an end to it, he shut his eyes and let go. He landed heavily on his bottom and continued on over backwards, coming to rest with his knees in the air above him.
"Al, are you all right?" Enid called.
"I don't understand this furniture," he said, struggling to sit up and sound powerful. "Is this meant to be a sofa?"
Denise came out and put a vase of 3 sunflowers on the spindly table by the chaise. "It's like a sofa," she said. "You can put your legs up and be a French philosophe. You can talk about Schopenhauer." Alfred shook his head. Enid enunciated from the kitchen doorway,
"Dr. Hedgepeth says you should only sit in high, straight-backed chairs."
Since Alfred showed no interest in these instructions, Enid repeated them to Denise when she returned to the kitchen.
"High, straight-backed chairs only," she said. "But Dad won't listen. He insists on sitting in his leather chair. Then he shouts for me to come and help him get up. But if I hurt my back, then where are we? I put one of those nice old ladder-back chairs by the TV downstairs and told him, 'Sit here.' But he'd rather sit in his leather chair, and then, to get out of it, he slides down the cushion until he's on the floor. Then he crawls on the floor to the ping-pong table and uses the ping-pong table to hoist himself up."
"That's actually pretty resourceful," Denise said as she took an armload of food from the refrigerator.
"Denise, he's crawling across the floor. Rather than sit in a nice, comfortable, straight-backed chair, which the doctor says it's important that he sit in, he crawls across the floor. He shouldn't be sitting so much to begin with. Dr. Hedgepeth says his condition is not at all severe if he would just get out and do a little. Use it or lose it, that's what every doctor says. Dave Schumpert has had 10 times more health problems than Dad. He's had a colostomy for 15 years. He's got 1 lung and a pacemaker, and look at all the things that he and Mary Beth are doing. They just got back from snorkeling in Fiji. And Dave never complains, never complains. You probably don't remember Gene Grillo, Dad's old friend from Hephaestus, but he has had bad Parkinson's, much, much worse than Dad's. He's still at home in Fort Wayne, but in a wheelchair now. He's really in awful shape. But, Denise, he's interested in things. He can't write anymore, but he sent us an audio letter on a cassette tape, really thoughtful, where he talks about each of his grandchildren in detail because he knows his grandkids and takes an interest in them, and about how he started to teach himself Cambodian, which he calls Khmer from listening to a tape and watching the Cambodian, or Khmer, I guess, TV channel in Fort Wayne, because their youngest son is married to a Cambodian woman, or Khmer, I guess, and her parents don't speak any English, and Jean wants to be able to talk to them a little. Can you believe? Here Jean is in a wheelchair, completely crippled, and he's still thinking about what he can do for somebody else. While Dad, who can walk and write and dress himself, does nothing all day but sit in his chair."
"Mother, he's depressed," Denise said in a low voice, slicing bread.
"That's what Gary and Caroline say, too. They say he's depressed and he should take a medication. They say he was a workaholic and that work was a drug which, when he couldn't have it anymore, he got depressed.
So drug him and forget him. A convenient theory."
"That's not fair to Gary. Don't get me started on Gary and Caroline. Golly, Denise, the way you throw that knife around, I don't see how you haven't lost a finger."
From the end of a French loaf, Denise had made three little crust-bottomed vehicles. On one she set shavings of butter, curved like sails full of wind. Into another she loaded Parmesan shards, packed in an excelsior of shredded arugula, and the third she paved with minced olive meat and olive oil and covered with a thick red tarp of pepper. Enid spoke.
Don't those look nice?
As she reached, cat quick for the plate on which Denise had arranged the snacks, but the plate eluded Enid.
These are for Dad. Just a corner of one.
I'll make some more for you.
No, I just want one corner of his.
But Denise left the kitchen and took the plate to Alfred, for whom the problem of existence was this, that in the manner of a wheat seedling thrusting itself up out of the earth, the world moved forward in time by adding cell after cell to its leading edge, piling moment on moment, and that to grasp the world, even in its freshest, youngest moment, provided no guarantee that you'd be able to grasp it again a moment later. By the time he'd established that his daughter Denise was handing him a plate of snacks in his son Chip's living room, the next moment in time was already budding itself into a pristinely ungrasped existence in which he couldn't absolutely rule out the possibility, for example, that his wife, Enid, was handing him a plate of feces in the parlor of a brothel. And no sooner had he reconfirmed Denise and the snacks and Chip's living room than the leading edge of time added yet another layer of new cells so that he again faced a new and ungrasped world. Which was why, rather than exhaust himself playing catch-up, he preferred more and more to spend his days down among the unchanging, historical roots of things.
"Something to tide you while I get lunch," Denise said.
Alfred gazed with gratitude at the snacks, which were holding about 90% steady as food, flickering only occasionally into objects of similar size and shape.
"Maybe you'd like a glass of wine?"
"Not necessary," he said.
As the gratitude spread outward from his heart, as he was moved, his clasped hands and lower arms began to bounce more freely on his lap. He tried to find something in the room that didn't move him, something he could rest his eyes on safely. But because the room was Chip's, and because Denise was standing in it, every fixture and every surface, even a radiator knob, even a thigh-level expanse of faintly scuffed wall, was a reminder of the separate eastern worlds in which his children led their lives, and hence of the various vast distances that separated him from them, which made his hands shake all the more. That the daughter whose attentions most aggravated his affliction was the person he least wanted to be seen by in the grip of this affliction was the sort of devil's logic that confirmed a man's pessimism.
"I'll leave you alone for a minute," Denise said, "while I get the lunch going."
He closed his eyes and thanked her, as if waiting for a break in a downpour so that he could run from his car into a grocery store. He waited for a lull in his tremor so that he could reach out and safely eat what she'd brought him. His affliction offended his sense of ownership. These shaking hands belonged to nobody but him, and yet they refused to obey him. They were like bad children, unreasoning two-year-olds in a tantrum of selfish misery. The more sternly he gave orders, the less they listened, and the more miserable and out of control they got. He'd always been vulnerable to a child's recalcitrance and refusal to behave like an adult. Irresponsibility and undiscipline were the bane of his existence. And it was another instance of that devil's logic that his own untimely affliction should consist of his body's refusal to obey him. "If thy right hand offend thee," Jesus said, "cut it off." As he waited for the tremor to abate, as he watched his hands jerking, rowing motions impotently, as if he were in a nursery with screaming, misbehaving infants, and had lost his voice and couldn't make them quiet down. Alfred took pleasure in the imagination of chopping his hand off with a hatchet, of letting the transgressing limb know how deeply he was angry with it, how little he loved it if it insisted on disobeying him. It brought a kind of ecstasy to imagine the first deep bite of the hatchet's blade in the bone and muscle of his offending wrist. But along with the ecstasy, right beside it, was an inclination to weep for this hand that was his, that he loved and wished the best for, that he'd known all its life. He was thinking about Chip again without noticing it. He wondered where Chip had gone, how he'd driven Chip away again. Denise's voice and Enid's voice in the kitchen were like a larger bee and a smaller bee trapped behind a window screen. And his moment came, the lull that he'd been waiting for. Leaning forward and steadying his taking hand with his supporting hand, he grasped the butter-sailed schooner and got it off the plate, bore it aloft without capsizing it, and then, as it floated and bobbed, he opened his mouth and chased it down and got it. Got it! Got it! The crust cut his gums, but he kept the whole thing in his mouth and chewed carefully, giving his sluggish tongue wide berth. The sweet butter melting, the feminine softness of baked leavened wheat. There were chapters in Hedgepeth's booklets that even Alfred, fatalist and man of discipline that he was, couldn't bring himself to read. Chapters devoted to the problems of swallowing, to the late torments of the tongue, to the final breakdown of the signal system. The betrayal had begun in signals. The Midland Pacific Railroad, where for the last decade of his career he'd run the engineering department, and where, when he'd given an order, it was carried out, "Mr. Lambert, right away, sir," had served hundreds of one-elevator towns in West Kansas and West and Central Nebraska, towns of the kind that Alfred and his fellow executives had grown up in or near, towns that in their old age seemed the sicker for the excellent health of the mid-pack tracks running through them. Although the railroad's first responsibility was to its stockholders, its Kansan and Missourian officers, including Mark Jamberetz, the corporation counsel, had persuaded the board of managers that because a railroad was a pure monopoly in many hinterland towns, it had a civic duty to maintain service on its branches and spurs. Alfred personally had no illusions about the economic future of prairie towns where the median age was 50-plus, but he believed in rail and he hated trucks. And he knew firsthand what scheduled service meant to a town's civic pride, how the whistle of a train could raise the spirits on a February morning at 41 degrees north, 101 degrees west, and in his battles with the EPA and various DOTs, he'd learned to appreciate rural state legislators who could intercede on your behalf when you needed more time to clean up your waste oil tanks in the Kansas City yards. Or when some goddamned bureaucrat was insisting that you pay for 40% of a needless grade separation project at Country Road H. Years after the Sioux Line and the Great Northern and Rock Island had stranded dead and dying towns all across the northern plains, then the Mid-Pack had persisted in running short semi-weekly or even bi-weekly trains through places like Alvin and Pisgah Creek, New Charters and West Centerville. Unfortunately, this program had attracted predators. In the early 1980s, as Alfred neared retirement, the Mid-Pack was known as a regional carrier that, despite outstanding management and lush profit margins on its long-haul lines, had very ordinary earnings. The Mid-Pack had already repulsed one unwelcome suitor when it came under the acquisitive gaze of Hillard and Chauncey Roth, fraternal twin brothers from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, who had expanded a family meatpacking business into an empire of the dollar. Their company, the Orphic Group, included a chain of hotels, a bank in Atlanta, an oil company, and the Arkansas Southern Railroad. The Roths had lopsided faces and dirty hair and no discernible desires or interests apart from making money. Oak Ridge Raiders, the financial press called them. At an early exploratory meeting that Alfred attended, Chauncey Roth persisted in addressing the Midpack CEO as Dad.
"I'm well aware it don't seem like fair play to you, Dad. Well, Dad, why don't you and your lawyers go ahead and have that little chat right now? Gosh, and here Hillard and myself was under the impression, Dad, that you're operating a business, not a charity."
This kind of anti-paternalism played well with the railroad's unionized workforce, which after months of arduous negotiations voted to offer the Roths a package of wage and work rule concessions worth almost $200 million. With these prospective savings in hand, plus 27% of the railroad stock, plus limitless junk financing, the Roths made an irresistible tender offer and bought the railroad outright. A former Tennessee Highway Commissioner, Fenton Creel, was hired to merge the railroad with the Arkansas Southern. Creel shut down the Midpack's headquarters in St. Jude, fired or retired a third of its employees, and moved the rest to Little Rock. Alfred retired 2 months before his 65th birthday. He was at home watching Good Morning America in his new blue chair when Mark Jamberetz, the Midpack's retired corporation counsel, called with the news that a sheriff in New Charters, pronounced Charters, Kansas, had had himself arrested for shooting an employee of Orphic Midland. "The sheriff's name is Bryce Hallstrom," Jamberetz told Alfred. "He got a call that some roughnecks were trashing Midpack signal wires. He went over to the siding and saw three fellows ripping down the wire, smashing signal boxes, coiling up anything copper. One of them took a county bullet in his hip before the others made Hallstrom understand they were working for the Midpack. Hired for copper salvage at 60 cents a pound."
"But that's a good new system," Alfred said. "It's not 3 years since we upgraded the whole new charter spur."
"The Roths are scrapping everything but the trunk lines," Jamberett said. "They're junking the Glendora cutoff. You think the Atchison Topeka wouldn't make a bid on that?"
"Well," Alfred said.
"It's a Baptist morality gone sour," said Jamberetz. "The Roths can't abide that we admitted any principle but the ruthless pursuit of profit. I'm telling you, they hate what they can't comprehend, and now they're sowing salt in the fields. Close down headquarters in St. Jude? When we're twice the size of Arkansas Southern? They're punishing St. Jude for being the home of the Midland Pacific. And Creel's punishing the towns like New Charters for being mid-pack towns. He's sowing salt in the fields of the financially unrighteous."
"Well," Alfred said again, his eyes drawn to his new blue chair and its delicious potential as a sleep site. "Not my concern anymore."
But he'd worked for 30 years to make the Midland Pacific a strong system. And Jamberetz continued to call him and send him news reports of fresh Kansan outrages, and it all made him very sleepy. Soon hardly a branch or spur in Midpack's western district remained in service. But apparently Fenton Creel was satisfied with pulling down the signal wires and gutting the boxes. 5 years after the takeover, the rails were still in place. The right-of-way was undisposed of, only the copper nervous system, in an act of corporate self-vandalism, had been dismantled.
"And now I'm worried about our health insurance," Enid told Denise. "Orphic Midland is switching all the old Midpack employees to managed care no later than April. I have to find an HMO that has some of Dad's and my doctors on their list. I'm deluged with prospectuses where the differences are all in the fine print, and honestly, Denise, I don't think I can handle this."
As if to forestall being asked for help, Denise quickly said,
"What plans does Hedgepeth accept?" "Well, except for his old fee-for-service patients, like Dad, he's exclusive now with Dean Driblet's HMO," Enid said. "I told you about the big party at Dean's gorgeous, huge new house. Dean and Trish really are about the nicest young couple I know, but golly, Denise, I called his company last year after Dad fell down on the lawnmower, and you know what they wanted for cutting our little lawn? $55 a week. I'm not opposed to profit. I think it's wonderful that Dean's successful. I told you about his trip to Paris with Honey. I'm not saying anything against him, but $55 a week.
Denise sampled Chip's green bean salad and reached for the olive oil.
What would it cost to stay with fee-for-service? Denise, hundreds of dollars a month extra. Not one of our good friends has managed care. Everybody has fee-for-service, but I don't see how we can afford it. Dad was so conservative with his investments, we're lucky to have any cushion for emergencies, and this is something else I'm very, 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 very worried about.
Enid lowered her voice.
One of Dad's old patents is finally paying off, and I need your advice.
She stepped out of the kitchen and made sure that Alfred couldn't hear.
Al, how you doing?
She shouted. He was cradling his second hors d'oeuvre, the little green boxcar below his chin. As if he'd captured a small animal that might escape again, he shook his head without looking up. Enid returned to the kitchen with her purse.
He finally has a chance to make some money, and he's not interested. Gary talked to him on the phone last month and tried to get him to be a little more aggressive, but Dad blew up.
Denise stiffened.
What was Gary wanting you to do? Just be a little more aggressive. Here, I'll show you the letter. Mother, those patents are Dad's. You have to let him handle it however he wants.
Enid hoped that the envelope at the bottom of her purse might be the missing registered letter from the Axon Corporation. In her purse, as in her house, lost objects did sometimes marvelously resurface. But the envelope she found was the original certified letter, which had never been lost.
"Read this," she said, "and see if you agree with Gary."
Denise set down the can of cayenne pepper with which she dusted Chip's salad. Enid stood at her shoulder and reread the letter to make sure it still said what she remembered. "Dear Dr. Lambert, on behalf of the Axon Corporation, 24 East Industrial Serpentine, Schwanksville, Pennsylvania, I'm writing to offer you a lump sum payment of $5,000 for the full, exclusive, and irrevocable right to United States Patent Number 4934417, Therapeutic Ferroacetate Gel Electropolymerization, for which you are original and sole holder of license. The management of Axon regrets that it cannot offer you a larger fee. The company's own product is in the earliest stages of testing, and there is no guarantee that its investment will bear fruit. If the terms outlined in the attached licensing agreement are acceptable, please sign and have notarized all three copies and return them to me no later than September 30. Sincerely yours, Joseph K. Prager, Senior Associate Partner, Bragg, Neuter & Spey. When this letter had arrived in the mail in August, and Enid had awakened Alfred in the basement, he'd shrugged and said,
$5,000 won't change the way we live.
Enid had suggested that they write to the Axon Corporation and ask for a larger fee, but Alfred shook his head.
We'll have soon spent $5,000 on a lawyer, he said, and then where are we?
It didn't hurt to ask, though, Enid said.
I will not ask, Alfred said.
But if he just wrote back, Enid said, and asked for $10,000. She fell silent as Alfred fixed her with a look. She might as well have proposed that they make love. Denise had taken a bottle of wine from the refrigerator as if to underline her indifference to a matter of consequence to Enid. Sometimes Enid believed that Denise had disdain for every last thing she cared about. The sexual tightness of Denise's blue jeans, as she bumped a drawer shut with her hip, sent this message. The assurance with which she drove a corkscrew into the cork sent this message.
"Do you want some wine?"
Enid shuddered.
"It's so early in the day."
Denise drank it like water.
"Knowing Gary," she said, "I'm guessing he said try to gouge them." "No, well, see..."
Enid reached toward the bottle with both hands.
"Just a tiny drop. Pour me just a swallow. Honestly, I never drink this early in the day. Never. You see, but Gary wonders why the company is even bothering with the patent if they're still so early in their development. I guess the usual thing is just to infringe on the other person's patent. That's too much, Denise. I don't like so much wine. Because, See, the patent expires in 6 years, so Gary thinks the company must stand to make a lot of money soon.
Did Dad sign the agreement?
Oh, yeah, he went over to the Schumperts and had Dave notarize it.
Then you have to respect his decision.
Denise, he's being stubborn and unreasonable. I can't...
Are you saying this is an issue of competency?
No. No. This is fully in character. I just can't...
If he already signed the agreement, Denise said, what is Gary imagining you're going to do?
Nothing, I guess.
So what's the point here?
Nothing. You're right, Enid said. There's nothing we can do.
Although, in fact, there was. If Denise had been a little less partisan in her support of Alfred, Enid might have confessed that after Alfred had given her the notarized agreement to mail at the post office on her way to the bank, she'd hidden the agreement in the glove compartment of their car, and had let the envelope sit and radiate guilt for several days, and that later, while Alfred was napping, she'd hidden the envelope more securely at the back of a laundry room cabinet containing jars of undesirable jams and spreads going gray with age, kumquat raisin, brandy pumpkin, Korean barfleberry, and vases and baskets and cubes of florist's clay, too good to throw away but not good enough to use, and that, as a result of this dishonest act, she and Alfred could still extract a big licensing fee from Axon, and that it was therefore crucial that she locate the second registered letter from Axon and hide it before Alfred found out that she'd deceived and disobeyed him.
"Oh, but that reminds me," she said, emptying her glass. "There's something else I really need your help with."
Denise hesitated before replying with a polite and cordial,
"Yes?"
This hesitation confirmed Enid's long-held belief that she and Alfred had taken a wrong turn somewhere in Denise's upbringing, had failed to instill in their youngest child the proper spirit of generosity and cheerful service.
"Well, as you know," Enid said, "we've gone to Philadelphia for the last 8 Christmases in a row, and Gary's boys are old enough now that they might like to have a memory of Christmas at their grandparents' house, and so I thought—"
"Damn!"
came a cry from the living room. Enid set down her glass and hurried from the kitchen. Alfred was sitting on the edge of the chaise in a somehow penal posture, his knees high and his back a little hunched, and was surveying the crash site of his third hors d'oeuvre. The gondola of bread had slipped from his fingers on its approach to his mouth and plunged to his knee, scattering wreckage and tumbling to the floor and finally coming to rest beneath the chaise. A wet pelt of roasted red pepper had adhered to the chaise's flank. Shadows of oil soak were forming around each clump of olive morsels on the upholstery. The emptied gondola lay on its side, with its yellow-soaked, brown-stained white interior showing. Denise squeezed past Enid with a damp sponge and went and knelt by Alfred.
"Oh, Dad," she said, "these are hard to handle. I should have realized."
"Just get me a rag and I'll clean it up."
"No, here," Denise said.
Cupping one hand for a receptacle, she brushed the bits of olive from his knees and thighs. His hands shook in the air near her head as if he might have to push her away, but she did her work quickly, and soon she'd sponged the bits of olive up from the floor and was carrying the dirtied food back to the kitchen, where Enid had wanted a tiny extra splash of wine, and in her hurry not to be conspicuous, had poured a rather substantial tiny splash and downed it quickly.
"Anyway," she said, "I thought that if you and Chip were interested, we could all have one last Christmas in St. Jude. What do you think of that idea?"
"I'll be wherever you and Dad want to be," Denise said.
"No, I'm asking you, though. I want to know if it's something you're especially interested in doing. If you'd especially like to have one last Christmas in the house you grew up in, does it sound like it might be fun for you?"
"I can tell you right now," Denise said, "there's no way Caroline's leaving Philly. It's a fantasy to think otherwise. So if you want to see your grandkids, you'll have to come east."
"Denise, I'm asking what you want." Gary says he and Caroline haven't ruled it out. I need to know if a Christmas in St. Jude is something that you really, really want for yourself. Because if all the rest of us are agreed that it's important to be together as a family in St. Jude one last time, Mother, it's fine with me, if you think you can handle it. I'll need a little help in the kitchen is all. I can help you in the kitchen, but I can only come for a few days. You can't take a week? No. Why not? Mother?
Damn!
Alfred cried again from the living room as something vitreous, maybe a vase containing sunflowers, hit the floor with a cracking open sound, a gulp of breakage.
Damn! Damn!
Enid's own nerves were so splintery she almost dropped her wine glass, and yet a part of her was grateful for this second mishap, whatever it was, because it gave Denise a small taste of what she had to put up with every day, around the clock, at home in St. Jude. The night of Alfred's 75th birthday had found Chip alone at Tilton Ledge pursuing sexual congress with his red chaise long. It was early January, and the woods around Carparts Creek were soggy with melting snow. Only the shopping center sky above central Connecticut and the digital readouts of his home electronics cast light on his carnal labors. He was kneeling at the feet of his chaise and sniffing its plush minutely, inch by inch, in hopes that some vaginal tang might still be lingering 8 weeks after Melissa Paquette had lain here. Ordinarily distinct and identifiable smells, dust, sweat, urine, the dayroom reek of cigarette smoke, the fugitive after-scent of Quim, became abstract and indistinguishable from over-smelling, and so he had to pause again and again to refresh his nostrils. He worked his lips down into the chaise's buttoned navels and kissed the lint and grit and crumbs and hairs that had collected in them. None of the three spots where he thought he smelled Melissa was unambiguously tangy, but after exhaustive comparison, he was able to settle on the least questionable of the three spots, near a button just south of the backrest, and gave it his full nasal attention. He fingered other buttons with both hands, the cool plush chafing his nether parts in a poor approximation of Melissa's skin, until finally he achieved sufficient belief in the smell's reality, sufficient faith that he still possessed some relic of Melissa, to consummate the act. Then he rolled off his compliant antique and slumped on the floor with his pants undone and his head on the cushion, an hour closer to having failed to call his father on his birthday. He smoked two cigarettes, lighting the second off the first. He turned on his television to a cable channel that was running a marathon of old Warner Brothers cartoons. At the edge of the pool of tubal glow, he could see the mail that for nearly a week he'd been dropping unopened on the floor. Three letters from the college's new acting provost were in the pile, also something ominous from the teacher's retirement fund, also a letter from the college housing office with the words, "Notice of Eviction," on the front of the envelope. Earlier in the day, while killing some hours by circling in blue ballpoint ink every uppercase M in the front section of a month-old New York Times, Chip had concluded that he was behaving like a depressed person. Now, as his telephone began to ring, it occurred to him that a depressed person ought to continue staring at the TV and ignore the ringing, ought to light another cigarette and, with no trace of emotional affect, watch another cartoon while his machine took whoever's message. That his impulse, instead, was to jump to his feet and answer the phone? That he could so casually betray the arduous wasting of a day cast doubt on the authenticity of his suffering? He felt as if he lacked the ability to lose all volition and connection with reality the way depressed people did in books and movies. It seemed to him, as he silenced the TV and hurried into his kitchen, that he was failing even at the miserable task of falling properly apart. He zipped up his pants, turned on a light, and lifted the receiver. "Hello?
What's going on there, Chip?"
Denise said, without preliminaries. I just talked to Dad, and he said he hadn't heard from you.
Denise, Denise, why are you shouting?
I'm shouting, she said, because I'm upset because it's Dad's 75th birthday, and you haven't called him, and you didn't send him a card. I'm upset because I've been working for 12 hours, and I just called Dad, and he's worried about you. What's going on there?
Chip surprised himself by laughing. What's going on is that I've lost my job.
You didn't get tenure?
No. I was fired, he said. They didn't even let me teach the last 2 weeks of classes. Somebody else had to give my exams. And I can't appeal the decision without calling a witness, and if I try to talk to my witness, it's just further evidence of my crime.
Who's the witness? Witness to what?
Chip took a bottle from the recycling bin, double-checked its emptiness, and returned it to the bin. A former student of mine says I'm obsessed with her. She says I had a relationship with her and wrote her a term paper in a motel room. And unless I get a lawyer, which I can't afford to do because they've cut my pay off, I'm not allowed to speak to this student. If I try to see her, it's considered stalking.
Is she lying? Denise said.
Not that this is anything Mom and Dad need to know about.
Chip, is she lying?
Spread open on Chip's kitchen counter was the section of the Times in which he'd circled all the uppercase M's. Rediscovering this artifact now, hours later, would have been like remembering a dream, except that a remembered dream didn't have the power to pull a waking person back into it, whereas the sight of a heavily marked story about severe new curtailments in Medicare and Medicaid benefits induced in Chip the same feeling of unease and unrealized lust, the same longing for unconsciousness that had sent him to the chaise to sniff and grope. He had to struggle now to remind himself that he'd already gone to the chaise. He'd already taken that route to comfort and forgetfulness. He folded the Times and dropped it on top of his heaping trash can. "I never had sexual relations with that woman," he said.
"You know, I'm judgmental about a lot of things," Denise said, "but not about things like this."
"I said I didn't sleep with her."
"I'm stressing, though," Denise said, "that this is one area where absolutely anything you say to me will fall on sympathetic ears."
And she cleared her throat pointedly. If Chip had wanted to come clean to someone in his family, his little sister would have been the obvious choice. Having dropped out of college and having married badly, Denise at least had some acquaintance with darkness and disappointment. Nobody but Enid, however, had ever mistaken Denise for a failure. The college she'd dropped out of was better than the one that Chip had graduated from, and her early marriage and more recent divorce had given her an emotional maturity that Chip was all too aware of lacking himself. And he suspected that even though Denise was working 80 hours a week, she still managed to read more books than he did. In the last month, since he'd embarked on projects like digitally scanning Melissa Paquette's face from a freshman Facebook and suturing her head to obscene downloaded images and tinkering with these images pixel by pixel, and the hours did fly by when you were tinkering with pixels, he'd read no books at all. "There was a misunderstanding," he told Denise dully, "and then it was like they could hardly wait to fire me. And now I'm being denied due process."
"Frankly," Denise said, "it's hard to see being fired as a bad thing. Colleges are nasty."
"This was the one place in the world I thought I fit in."
"I'm saying it's very much to your credit that you don't. Although, what are you surviving on financially?"
"Who said I was surviving?"
"Do you need a loan?"
"Denise, you don't have any money."
"Yes, I do. I'm also thinking you should talk to my friend Julia. She's the one in film development. I told her about that idea you had for an East Village Troilus and Cressida. She said you should call her if you're interested in writing."
Chip shook his head as if Denise were with him in the kitchen and could see him. They'd talked on the phone months ago about modernizing some of Shakespeare's less famous plays, and he couldn't bear that Denise had taken that conversation seriously, that she still believed in him.
"What about Dad, though?" she said. "Did you forget it's his birthday?"
"I lost track of time here.
I wouldn't push you, Denise said, except that I was the person who opened your Christmas box.
Christmas was a bad scene, no question.
Which package went to whom was pretty much guesswork.
Outside, a wind from the south had picked up, a thawing wind that quickened the patter of snowmelt on the back patio. The sense that Chip had had when the phone rang, that his misery was optional, had left him again.
"So are you going to call him?" Denise said.
He replaced the receiver in its cradle without answering her, turned off the ringer, and pressed his face into the doorframe. He'd solved the problem of family Christmas gifts on the last possible nailing day when, in a great rush, he'd pulled old bargains and remainders off his bookshelves and wrapped them in aluminum foil and tied them up with red ribbon and refused to imagine how his 9-year-old nephew, Caleb, for example, might react to an Oxford annotated edition of Ivanhoe whose main qualification as a gift was that it was still in its original shrink wrap. The corners of the books had immediately poked through the aluminum foil, and the foil he'd added to cover up the holes hadn't adhered well to the underlying layers, and the result had been a soft and peely kind of effect, like onion skin or phyllo dough, which he'd tried to mitigate by plastering each package with the National Abortion Rights Action League holiday stickers that he'd received in his annual membership kit. His handiwork had looked so clumsy and childish, so mentally unbalanced, really, that he tossed the packages into an old grapefruit carton just to get them out of sight. Then he FedExed the carton down to Gary's house in Philadelphia. He felt as if he'd taken an enormous dump, as if, no matter how smeary and disagreeable it had been, he at least was emptied out now and wouldn't be back in this position soon. But 3 days later, returning home late on Christmas night after a 12-hour vigil at the Dunkin' Donuts in Norwalk, Connecticut, he faced the problem of opening the gifts his family had sent him, 2 boxes from St. Jude, a padded mailer from Denise, and a box from Gary. He decided that he would open the packages in bed, and that the way he would get them up to his bedroom would be to kick them up the stairs, which proved to be a challenge because oblong objects had a tendency not to roll up a staircase but to catch on the steps and tumble back down. Also, if the contents of a padded mailer were too light to offer inertial resistance, it was difficult to get any lift when you kicked it, but Chip had had such a frustrating and demoralizing Christmas. He'd left a message on Melissa's college voicemail asking her to call him at the payphone at the Dunkin' Donuts or, better yet, to come over in person from her parents' house in nearby Westport. And not until midnight